A different future starts with you. That's why GoDaddy does more than help you find a name. You can create, sell, and get found online so any small business can make a change. We need a new generation of thinking, your way of thinking. Start different at GoDaddy.com.
COVID-19 patients need your help.
If you've fully recovered from COVID-19
or unknowingly been exposed to it,
you may have the antibodies that could help COVID-19 patients recover.
Donate blood and receive testing for COVID-19 antibodies.
Visit Vitalant.org today to schedule an appointment to donate blood.
That's Vitalant.org. Help save lives and schedule your appointment at Vitalant.org.
You could help save lives.
This is an ode to Napa cabbage. Of all the cabbages on all the cabbage farms, only you have the crisp crunch worthy of our Bibigo Korean dumplings. No other cabbage would do, because no other cabbage tastes like you. We love you, Napa cabbage. Just don't tell Green Onion. Napa cabbage, one of many obsessively crafted ingredients in every hearty, flavorful Korean dumpling from Bibigo. Go handcrafted. Go Bibigo. Authentic Korean dumplings now in the freezer aisle.
This is Podco Media Networks.
It's the Innovation Podcast with Mark Reed Edwards and Garnett Harriman. Let's start the show.
Hi, it's Mark. Garnett, how are you doing on this fine October day?
Doing just good. How are you? Everything good?
I'm fine, by my reckoning. You like that word, so I thought I'd repeat it.
That is some strange verbiage, I gotta tell you.
It's actually raining here and it's really miserable, and I've got a grocery delivery coming in like an hour or so, and it's going to be a real misery getting it in from outside. But what are you going to do?
That's right.
Aren't you going to ask me what the weather is in Laguna Beach?
No, because I know it's perfect.
Well, whatever. All right.
I've learned. I'm not going to make small talk with you anymore.
Well, not about the weather. In Laguna Beach. I mean,
anyway, let's turn to the business at hand. We have a great guest today, Keith Cartwright, who founded his agency, Cartwright, in February. He also co-founded Saturday Morning, an organization that helps build awareness, promote change, and shift the overall perception that Black lives are in some way not as important as others. Plus, we just found this out, he is an Orangeman. He went to Syracuse University, and it's great to have you here, Keith.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So we want to talk today about Saturday Morning, but before we do, can you share your background, maybe mention why the heck you went from California to Syracuse University and experienced the worst winter on record, and tell us about the recent launch of your agency?
Sure. The first story, I think... I don't know if I have a sensical answer. You got to remember, I was 18 years old, so it's slightly sensical. I was an art student. I still consider myself an art student, but I was a true art student, whereby I wanted to go to school for fine art and specifically painting. Mm-hmm. And I had spent my whole life gearing up for that. And I had a wonderful art teacher in high school. And she really worked with me to put my portfolio together. And I got accepted a lot of different art schools, Pratt and Otis and Syracuse was one of them that I really loved because it was a university experience. And I didn't want to just be relegated to art school. I wanted an art school within a university so I could have a full college experience. Mm-hmm. And Syracuse had been doing that for a very long time and had an incredible reputation for art, fine art. And design. And so I found myself in one of the coldest places in the country. I had, we grew up with very humble means. My family, you know, my dad's a minister, my mom's a speech pathologist. So we didn't make a lot of money. And so my mom packed me up. I had a comforter set, one of those large green military backpacks with one winter coat and a pair of winter boots. Got there. And those things didn't last very long. Thank God for work study. I got to shop at the Carousel Mall and went and got me the right gear for winter. Anyway, that was a long story, but that was why.
Yeah.
But the great thing about that experience is it brought me into design, specifically communication design. And they had a wonderful program there led by one of my mentors, Ken Hine. And Ken started the program. And the way he geared it was, it wasn't just about learning about graphic design, visual design, communication design, however you want to describe it. It was about thinking conceptually and using design as impetus to solve problems visually. Mm-hmm. So we had to write our own briefs and create our own projects. And, you know, critiques were as if we were presenting to clients. We had to pick real clients, solve real problems. So that set me up really, really well to go into the business that I'm in today. And it also kind of sparked the entrepreneurial spirit that I have in a lot of ways, because it really showed me that I like thinking on my own. I have a vision and I like to explore that vision. And I feel like people will be interested in that vision. So I've worked in the industry a long time. I've worked at some great places, worked at Shiat, worked at Wieden Kennedy, worked at 72 and Sunny. But in all those places, I've learned tremendous amounts of ways of working. But I've never had as much fun or felt as actualized as I am now with my own agency. And it's been proving out.
Yeah, that's great. So can you tell us about Saturday Morning? What caused you to found that and what it's all about?
Yeah, that was a different experience. You know, I was already deep into my career. I'd been in business almost 20 years. And obviously being an African American, I'm very aware of all the things that have affected my life personally and things that happen in the community are unfortunately not surprising to me. I think that's one thing that a lot of people don't realize about African Americans is that these things that are happening are not new. Mm. We have, our aunts and uncles and grandparents and parents tell us these stories that don't make headline news all the time because they happen all the time. And they teach us to be aware of these things because it's our way of life. It's the things that we have to experience. So the fact that America woke up, I'll say within the past 3 or 4 years, to a lot of the atrocities that have been going on is because people put a camera on it and force people to pay attention. It's very similar to the civil rights movement when Dr. King was smart enough, intelligent enough, and his those who worked with him were intelligent enough to say, we need to make sure that the world sees what's going on because we need white allyship in order to move and progress our agenda. It can't just be us alone fighting in the dark corners of this country. So Saturday Morning was brought about because of those things. It was right after the killing of Alton Sterling and Philando Castillo. And I reached out to some other prominent creative directors in the business. I happened to be in LA at that time. They were all in LA and we met up at the Rose Cafe. And I just said, hey, we
need love that place.
Yeah, it's great. It was a great time because we ended up talking, started as just brunch and it turned into almost dinner.
Whoa.
Because we had never sat down together and actually had a conversation about these things and all of our similar experiences in the business. We all admired each other. We all knew of each other. We were all friendly, but that changed everything. So we agreed to pen a letter to the rags and just kind of give our viewpoint on how we felt. And the industry, thankfully, didn't allow us to stop there. And that turned into Saturday Morning. There were outreaches and calls for us to build it and turn it into something more substantial. And I think we did.
Is that the letter that calls for sacrifice, not sympathy? And could you elaborate on that a little bit?
That was actually our second letter. The first letter was just, it was much kinder. It was a bit kinder in that we were introducing ourselves, talking about what Saturday Morning means. And it was a call to arms to allyship from businesses, to marketers, to humans, to creatives, to anyone who was interested, to help build this sort of coalition of the willing to use creativity to help sort of diffuse and debunk the myths about our culture and our society. So that went out and then that forced us to form a nonprofit and forced us to create a business. The letter you're talking about came out this year. And that letter was focused on a really clear thesis. We said, look, it's talk and action. Our compadres, they certainly aren't the exact same thing. And there was a lot of conversation going on, but in our opinion, not enough action. So it was a call for action and a call to action. And it was a call to action for specifically white allyship. But there's also a paragraph in there that speaks to this power structure that we're fighting against. In our opinions, is really predicated on two things. It's a myth. based in what we called so-called whiteness, and I can give you some detail into that. But it's all based in financial power, right? It creates this thing as a power structure that has been built a long, long time ago. And sustaining that power structure allows for, let's just say, those who are not allies to retain position and control over quote unquote other. And it has nothing to do with anything else. So, you know, although there's brainwashing that has gone on for centuries to give reasons why there's an us and them, it's really not based in anything outside of sort of this mythological fairy tale story that outside of the color of my skin, I'm different than you. So, you know, the letter really kind of went into that. And I mentioned this idea of so-called whiteness. You know, we are all an amalgamation of different cultures. You know, I am not just African. And white people, as we so call them, are an amalgamation of different cultures from all over the globe as well. There's mixes of Italians and who are mixed with Irish and Eastern Europeans. And so for us to sort of create these monoliths is for no other reason than to separate us and not bring us together.
Yeah, that's profound. I mean, and I love that you are calling out the financial power sort of justification for a lot of this, because there's a lot of like post facto exclusion that happens in America. I don't know Europe that well. I don't know many other countries as well as I know the US. There's a lot of post facto justification that results in exclusion, but it really sounds racial at a certain, you know, at a certain level. But at the end of the day, it starts with financial power, and the in-group or the minority group that has that financial wanting to basically not, you know, not relinquish it and not open it up to like some of the things that really make this country great, like free and open competition.
That's right.
Of ideas and otherwise. I think that, you know, the sacrifice part really resonates. I feel like I've read a little bit about that call to action in some of the recent speeches and op-ed pieces of Darren Walker at Ford Foundation. Very powerful line of reasoning, I think. Let's move on. I want to get deeper into maybe some more, you know, economics and sort of financial and business-oriented things. Folks like Robert Smith are calling for corporations to move capital into Black-owned banks and other community financial institutions. What's your take on this sort of like very granular, nitty-gritty call to action versus larger calls to action?
I think it's necessary for when you are an oppressed group, you have to protect yourself, right? If you are not given the same, let's just call it rights as others, be it...
Or opportunities. Yeah.
As others, you have to find them on your own. You have to create them, right? And in order to find some level of justice or equality, you have to create it. You can only knock on the door and ask for so long before you have to take a hint that you're not going to get what you're looking for. So I think it's smart. I think until we can find some level of equality, be it with job opportunities or financial opportunities, we have to come together and sort of bind our own resources together and create those opportunities for one another so we can thrive and prosper and have a piece of the American dream like everybody else.
Makes a lot of sense. There's a lot of verbiage around equity, and I feel like the concept of equity of opportunity generally gets lost in the shuffle, and that's fundamentally, that's at the core of all of this, in my opinion. It's just no reason for the exclusion, you know, the pattern biases, all these sort of things. Not in this day and age. So hopefully we're on our way to changing, and we will see. I have a prediction to make about Mr. Smith. I think if Biden wins, Mr. Smith is going to be the Secretary of the Treasury.
Wow, a big prediction. That's a big call.
Yeah, there's so much like momentum and logic about it. Frankly, he's probably too rich to even want the job.
I've got a little notebook where I keep track of his predictions, so I'll let Dave on that one.
Yeah, let's.
What was the last one I made? I haven't made that many.
I'm kidding.
So I noticed on the Cartwright site, which I love, I was trying to debate Mark over what shade of orange that was, and I originally thought it was somewhere between tangerine and saffron, and now I'm thinking it's straight up blood orange, actually.
I'll get you Pantone.
Good. So I noticed on the site that there are some pretty highfalutin corporate clients in your client list. And I don't know if it's okay to name them or anything like that, but
I can kind of talk to you about that. I mean, we've had a great year. You know, it hasn't even been a full year yet. We've been doing some extensive work with the NBA. We helped them with this launch in the bubble. So the work this year was our effort.
And of all the leagues, they did the best job. And man, those games were great.
They were great. I think they did they kept the integrity of their product and they kept it exciting. It was fun to watch. And even outside of sport, you got to give credit to Silver. He figured it out, and they were diligent and they were wise and they were efficient in their process, and it worked. But anyway, that work will continue on next year. We're working with them on the next launch, which is obviously very exciting. We just won Häagen-Dazs, which is a big win for us. I love that.
Nice. Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you. So we're going to launch some really exciting work for them. We had an incredible project with Facebook that's going on right now that, for all I can say, is that it's steeped in sort of looking at them from the inside out. And really, they've been really open and vulnerable about who they are and what they stand for. And we've been working through that through the lens of the people that work there. So that's going to be a really exciting one to roll out. And that's coming out very soon. And, you know, we just won a piece of business, CBS News. And so that was they're rebranding themselves. And that work was supposed to roll out this Thursday during the debate, which I think is off, but the work will come out very soon. And it sort of repositions their news in a way that I think really differentiates them from other competitors. So, you know, that's been a year, and we're heads down on some new business stuff.
Nice.
Going into May. So we're excited about all that.
If you've recovered from COVID-19 or unknowingly been exposed to it, you may have antibodies that could help COVID-19 patients. Donate blood and receive testing for COVID-19 antibodies. Visit Vitalant.org today.
So let me go to the thing that really jumped out at me. It's the Häagen-Dazs piece of business, which is we've spent a lot of time talking to the mission investing folks at Ben & Jerry's. And Ben & Jerry's is a fairly controversial actor in the field of, like, whatever, social good and in general and diversity as well. They get called out for, what's the right word? Is it diversity theater? Mm-hmm. But the folks in Europe are fond of, like, criticizing Ben & Jerry's for, I think they call it virtue signaling. So I'm really excited that you're working with Häagen-Dazs, because, you know, it feels like you're going to lead them in a direction that is something other than diversity theater and virtue signaling. So
yeah, you know, look, excited. I don't know if that's a fair judgment of Häagen-Dazs, if I'm being honest. I'm sorry, Ben & Jerry's, if I'm being honest.
Right. Me neither. I'm just telling you what I've read.
Yeah, yeah, of course. And I know I've seen the same thing. I think Ben & Jerry's has always been, and the founders especially, have always been very outspoken about their beliefs. I don't know enough about, you know, what they're doing by way of investments and action. I know that they're doing a lot of marketing around important issues. So that's the question. But it is a part of their DNA. I mean, look, it's two hippies who started a ice cream company in San Francisco, and they've always been about that. So I don't know if you can completely look cross-eyed them. There are a lot of companies that you can. I don't know if we should be attacking Ben & Jerry's. But Häagen-Dazs, they've always been this luxury brand, and they've always been about sort of the upper echelon of taste and luxury. It's been part of their pedigree for a long time, and everybody knows that Häagen-Dazs was one of the first sort of original ice cream luxury brands. And I think they're really, really looking at ways to not lose that equity, but think about it through a modern lens, and then find ways through their brand to speak to what's going on in the world, to uplift communities, to have an altruistic voice. And I think we found something for them that is, it innately becomes a part of who they are, and it's not a tack on. We get a lot of phone calls, as you can imagine, just me being an African-American and having been one of the co-founders of Saturday Morning, we get a lot of phone calls from brands who just want that thing. They want a thing to say they did something, right? A piece of, like you said, some ad theater to put out in the world and say, look, we care. We spent $1 million on this thing. But their organization is not about it. And they're not really doing anything or interested in doing anything outside of that piece of marketing. And that we push back on that stuff because it has to be intrinsic, or what you end up doing is actually doing more damage than good. And it just, it's not good for our brand, Saturday Morning, and it's certainly not good for the brands that are asking us to do it.
Nice. So we've been looking at some big trends, Mark and I and my investment partners and I, especially demographic trends. It's according to the U.S. Census Bureau, it looks like this country is going to be more than 50% people of color by roughly 2045, which is an interesting shift, sort of codenaming it the multicultural mainstream. Is that something that you talk about a lot in your sort of brand strategy discussions and work that you do with these corporations?
Well, yeah, maybe not in those terms, but as far as our organization goes, it is very, very important that we have a diverse population. Diversity means it obviously includes, you know, gender and race. And we want to make sure that we are in the room. We are touching on, or at least we have a group of humans who have diverse experiences so that those experiences can inform the work. You know, I say all the time, like, look, yeah, I want a diverse group of people because I think it's the right thing to do, but I'm also a businessman. And I know that when you have those humans working together in the spirit of creativity, you're going to get a better product. And if I have a better product, it's going to drive more business and therefore more capital. So I don't know why I wouldn't do it. There's Harvard Business Review studies that are out there that talk about when businesses behave that way, their revenue goes up. They make more money. Mm-hmm. So the thing that is always curious to me is, if that's true, why aren't companies doing it? Why does it still feel like it's a nice to have? Why does it still feel like it's charity if they're quote unquote searching for more diverse talent? Instead of looking at it as an innovation, that's going to broaden the scope of work they have and bring in more revenue. If they look at it that way and they find someone who, they appoint someone who's accountable, they create a budget for this thing, and they give them goals to reach, they'll see a return. But they're not doing that. They're raising their hand, or they're calling me, or they're calling some of my other cohorts from Saturday Morning and say, hey, we just can't find anybody. Can you help us? Which to me is lazy. And that means you're not really looking at solving the problem. You want to just put a Band-Aid on it and hope that this movement turns into a moment and you can move on about your daily life.
That whole, there are so many permutations of that pipeline myth out there. And to your point, it leads to these sort of, to this token responses. But I hopefully working with Cartwright, working with Saturday Morning is the beginning of some, not only some brand strategy for the multicultural mainstream, but some inoculation that starts to change some of these corporations' basic DNA. And over time, right, they'll start to take that investment approach versus that philanthropy approach. But I may be overly optimistic on that one. I'm hoping for the best. You know. So just to follow that thought a little bit, are the corporations that you're talking to as clients and that pitching as prospective clients, are you hearing the need or the desire or the aspiration to do things that are more along the lines of, you know, investments, more along the line of optimizing and less along the lines of donations and philanthropy? Are you hearing calls to action in the former region versus the latter?
Are you talking about for Saturday Morning specifically, or
in general? Yeah, both. Any way you choose to answer it. Yeah.
I think a lot of what I'm seeing is the easy thing is donations, right? Because the action is transactional. It's a one-time thing. It's easy, and you can just put something up and say you donated this much to a cause. The hard thing to do is sacrifice. because it requires you to go outside of your norm and dedicate time that you may not have to something that you believe in. Sacrifice is when I personally believe that someone is actually trying to make change. They're dedicating their resources and their energy and their time because they are that motivated to see the needle move. When I don't see that, look, money is important. You give money to the right people, they'll do that for you. But it sort of limits the scope of how you're perceived as a business if that's all you do. It doesn't mean that you're in the trenches with them. It also limits your understanding because the conversation ends once you sign that check, mostly. When you're not in there every day working with them or trying to come up with your own solutions, failing, getting back up, learning, growing, how are you pushing the agenda of your business? You know, the CEO, in my opinion, of any company should be the chief diversity officer. Because like I was saying earlier, it's a revenue strategy. It's a part of your bottom line. It's not altruism. Part of your bottom line. It drives growth. And it's the CEO's job to do that. And if they're not thinking that way, if they're not focused on that, if they're not dedicated to that, then I sort of wonder how they feel about the entire initiative in the first place.
That's a really good way of looking. The CEO-CDO nexus that you just sort of, meaning chief diversity officer, that is a really cool way of phrasing it. I may have to steal that at some point because, so in all fairness, my day job is not podcasting, right? So I've been an investor for a long time. And earlier this year, I teamed up with a diversity investing pioneer named William Crowder, founded the Comcast Catalyst Fund and some other stuff at Morgan Stanley. And we're putting together our diversity fund. Yeah. And to Mark's earlier point, I'm fond of predictions. I'm pretty sure I'm not above 50% right. But one prediction I made earlier this year was that chief diversity officers for the first time in corporate history were going to start making investments and start being charged with implementing some of these corporate commitments along the lines of capital allocations. And that, I caught a lucky break on that. I was talking about that in January, February, and it's starting to, more and more chief diversity officers are actually starting to act like chief investment officers.
Right.
And it's because the CEO has to be, as to your point, the de facto chief diversity officer and is allocating some of these new responsibilities to these fortunate, I guess, in some ways, you know, new generation of chief diversity officers around corporate America. So it really, it's an interesting nexus of changes that are unfolded. I just hope it continues. I'm not sure how optimistic I am about the, you know, this continuing, you know, into next year and the year after. So hopefully that's the case.
I hope so. It's going to take, what I'm seeing, it's going to take, at least for our industry, I'll go even further than that.
Uh-oh. Prediction, get the notebook out. Mark.
Yep, I'm on it.
I think what we saw this year is the power of consumers and their ability to shift brands. Shift brands to act, right? A lot of things happen because either fans or consumers decided we've had enough. And if their voice is loud enough, they can change things. And they did. So I think that's going to continue. I don't think that's going to stop. And I think that's going to be the driver, the biggest driver for change. Because I don't know if businesses have enough incentive on their own, or at least they don't believe in the incentives. Like I said earlier, the incentives are there. The data is there. But when the bottom line starts to drop immediately because they've been canceled, that promotes change quickly. Boards start to ask questions about CEOs and what they're doing and how they're acting. And you just start to see infrastructure shift. So that's my prediction. I think you know, when I look at Gen Z and just them wanting to believe in every single thing that they bring into their life and wanting to investigate because they have the tools to do it and they grew up on this computer, that's not going to stop. That's their innate behavior. And I think that can drive a lot of change in industry.
I think that's right. I think that's right. There's this curious alignment happening. So if you believe in the power of Gen Z and their sort of, I don't know, the social or political implications of their purchasing power, essentially that's what you're talking about. If you believe in that, there's something that predates all of this, because the data that you're citing is being like a no-brainer, and it's relatively new data, right? I mean, these studies are, you know, less than 5 years old, you know, maybe less than a couple of years old, whatever. All good, right? But there's this larger thing that's sitting out there. And I think people, even people in the know, you know, lawyers, investors, board members, you know, have always treated it fairly conceptually. And with the consumer behaviors like you're talking about, it's starting to become a lot less conceptual and more concrete. And the thing I'm talking about is fiduciary responsibility. So if you're a board member, you know, at a major corporation that is potentially at risk for either changes to the bottom line, negative changes to the bottom line, or at risk of being in existence altogether because they have made mistakes in the past, or you're not talking to the right consumers that you've made money off, you know, historically, and you're not including them in the brand story and the brand image. You know, the biggest risk to corporations today, in my opinion, comes directly and indirectly from wealth and economic inequities. So protest is just the tip of the iceberg. I mean, what happens if more and more people can't afford stuff, which is where we're headed in this country on some level? Dude, the stats are in for 2020. African-American founders of color are raising less money this year than last year. What the? I normally curse. I'm on my best behavior because I feel like, you know, I owe you an apology from our last aborted attempt to get this podcast done. So I'm being really polite. Normally, I just say, what the fuck?
Yeah. I mean, there you go.
But, you know, there are things that are happening that are moving in the right direction. But, and I'm hoping like a double team, like a bookend type thing, right? So you get these consumer behaviors and then you get, you know, more of the top down fear of God that comes from the fiduciary responsibility piece. And hopefully that becomes like a potent motive for changing things at the infrastructure level, not at the token level, right? We'll see how that plays out. It's obviously didn't happen overnight, so it's going to take some time to undo it. Let's go back real quick to Saturday morning. I'm curious. I don't see the word collective that often as an organizational descriptor or as a business organization descriptor. Why did you choose collective as the means of organizing your collaboration with these folks?
You know, I think our original intent, and to some degree it still exists, was that we are, as five or six humans with a vision, are not an agency. We're not trying to, we don't solicit clients in that way, and our purpose isn't to improve your and increase your marketing. We have really selfish goals that have to do with specifically African Americans and the perception of African Americans in modern day culture. And we believe that our creativity can solve that. I've said over and over again, and I know we all believe it, that creativity is the most powerful force in the world. It can change hearts and minds. But what we also realized is we couldn't do it alone. So our goal with every time we get a phone call or there's a potential project is we think through who our partners are. Sometimes those partners are just creative support. Sometimes those partners are production companies, directors, photographers, people within our circle who we know, trust, and love to help us bring those visions to life. But we start with a blank sheet of paper every time, and we think about collectively who we can bring into this to make it work. There's so many people who want to work with us, and what we generally say is, yes, that's what the collective is. You're a part of Saturday morning. We just have to find the right opportunity for you. Based on what we feel like they need, they being the potential client, to sort of satisfy or answer whatever business problem they have.
So it's not called a collective because you lost your faith in capitalism because of this institutionalized racism.
No, we haven't gotten there yet.
Well, there are some folks in the, like I would say the far left, you know, of the political spectrum who are out there writing things like this, you know, that
yes,
you know, we need to fix all of this institutionalized racism because the upshot is future generations. Oh shit, you know who it was? It was Calacanis. Jason Calacanis was writing about this, you know, fairly recently. The, you know, the investor dude, the launch syndicate,
yes,
Silicon Valley. So his argument was, if we don't get this fixed, the institutional racism thing, current and future generations of young entrepreneurs are going to lose their faith in capitalism. And we're going to start to see like a rebirth of the socialist movement in this country. That's what
I think. There's a lot of truth in that statement, because if capitalism can't figure out a way to be a bit more sort of at least equal in its opportunities.
That's right. That's right.
Then it's a flawed system, right? Because it's just giving to those who are already a part of the monoculture.
It's sort of turning, you know, if it doesn't get fixed in the relatively near future, it's going to start looking a lot like an oligarchy and, you know, basically a smaller, ever smaller, each generation will be a smaller group of people. And you combine that with the demographic changes and then, you know, it just, yeah, it can't, the
math doesn't add up. Yeah.
The center can't hold. It just,
right,
you know, there's a, I forget what the Yeats poem is, but, you know, there's like, it's the definition of entropy. It can't hold. So we'll see. I don't know. You know, I'm old, so I'm not necessarily confident that I'll live long enough to see the full flowering of this changes. But Mark is a youngster, so Mark will be.
Yeah. I'm older than you, Garnett. So
Mark's a whippersnapper, so he's counting on being around for all of these like wonderful manifestations in the future.
In mind, I'm a whippersnapper, but chronologically, I am not.
So I don't know if you have anything else that you want to add, Mark. Otherwise, I'm gonna put Keith on the spot one more time about predictions and my favorite part of the podcast. But you have any more questions?
Yeah, not to get too deep about capitalism, but really the kind of capitalism we were just discussing really isn't capitalism. It isn't free marketism.
Exactly right.
It's a bastardization of that for the benefit of a few people. It's not bringing yourself up by your own bootstraps. It's grabbing onto daddy's bootstraps, right? So to me, if we're going to be capitalist, let's really be capitalist.
Yep.
You know, let's not have some kind of parallel universe version of it where it only works for the benefit of some. Make it a really about opportunity.
Yeah, I agree with that.
I love it. You need to work on your tone and inflection, but basically your content is straight out of the African Episcopalian church. Good for you. Good for you.
Well, there you go.
All right, so here's my favorite part of this entire thing, Keith. Pleasure, real pleasure getting to know you a little bit.
Yes.
Predictions. I mean, anything. Sports, society, fashion, color scheme. I'm open to it all.
Ah, that's a good one. I think there is going to be in our lifetime, I think what I've seen through COVID, and you hear the whispers of it, there's going to be a revolution in the way we work, which I think is going to affect every single thing that we have talked about on this call.
Yep.
And I think the only blessing in this is that we've realized that we have, to some degree, I don't think these Zoom calls are perfect. They're not. But innovations are happening now. People are thinking about what we've gone through and experience and thinking about new ways to experience different ways of working that can be both interactive, but it also allows us to be sort of living in our own space and not having to have office space or commute, you know, an hour and a half to work every day or an hour to work every day. That's exciting because that affects the environment. That speaks to all the sort of biases that happen literally physically in the workspace. I hope those things go down because of this, because then you can really pay attention to who these people are, what they're giving. Certain anxieties, which are considered disabilities, can be checked. The innovation that's going to come from this, I think, is going to reshape the world. And I think it'll be the next revolution in this country in how we work, how we commute, and how we create business. And that's exciting to me because I think there's a lot of opportunity for all people in that.
We're going to have Keith back on to talk more about the innovation side of these changes, actually. That's a really fertile ground to explore in more detail.
Yeah. I mean, there's probably no business that has relied on face-to-face contact as much as the ad business. And so founding an agency in February and then, you know, the world completely changing a month later, you've had to kind of deal with it in real time. And the way in which you have is probably a good lesson for other businesses.
Yeah, that's one of the fortunate things, I think, for us. We talked a bit about this in our last chat. It wasn't known to me until much later. And I was just saying, like, we're doing really well on these calls and clients, whether they give us the business or they want to have more conversations, something's working. And I think it was because we didn't have to break down a process to figure out how to work with clients. We built a process based on our current situation. So it was innately fluid. We had to figure it out. I think a lot of agencies had to disassemble something and then figure out how to rebuild it. Mm-hmm. And then figure out how to educate those on the new system in a matter of months. We were very comfortable. We were very supportive and it was fluid. So I think that was probably one of our biggest advantages and still is, by the way, in a lot of our new business, because I think we have found a model, and I'm not going to throw a lot of these things out if we ever go into an office building, that has made the experience better for everyone on both sides of the Zoom call.
Yeah. There's part of that being able to collaborate across time and space that is a good skill to have and can enable you to be more flexible as an employer, as a collaborator with clients, and across the board, right? Good. Well, hey, this was great. It was great catching up with you again and focusing the discussion on Saturday morning and, you know, all of the cool things you're doing. It was wonderful having you on again, Keith.
Well, again, thank you for having me. It's always fun. These conversations are so good. I appreciate you having me on.
Thank you, Keith.
All right. Take care.
Thanks for joining Garnett and Mark on the Innovation Podcast. Visit theinnovationpodcast.co to subscribe and listen to other episodes.